to slow traffic. Here's Elaine Leung.
That's right, Sandy. Better news, it's gone. North 880 at Industrial, but still quite a bit of traffic out of Union City. Altamont Pass, that's still pretty heavy. West 580, make your way out to North Flynn. We had early morning troubles with a big rig off the roadway there. And getting word in Auburn, a crash. West 80 at Nevada Street, three vehicles involved with the right lane blocked. Elaine Leung for KQED.
All right, thanks, Elaine. Support for KQED comes from the Exploratorium. Extraordinary is a new exhibition of incredible art made from shoes, light bulbs, Lego, and more. Opens June 13th at Pier 15. Tickets at exploratorium.edu/extra. Temperatures today from the 50s at the coast to the low 80s inland and plenty of sunshine. KQED San Francisco, KQEI North Highlands, Sacramento. It's 11 o'clock.
Can stories we tell each other be weaponized? I'm Ira Plato, and this is Science Friday. There's an old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But that doesn't hold true in the world of psychological warfare. Author Annalee Newitz joins us to talk about how military psychological warfare techniques are being brought to modern politics.
It's not the opening stage in a debate. It is a weapon. They're delivering weaponized messages that can't be met with rational responses.
Plus, finding the world's largest known genome in a tiny fern.
We were absolutely astonished when we found out how big this genome was.
All coming up after the break. Stay with us.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. At a Normandy cliff, U.S. Army Rangers scaled 80 years ago on D-Day, President Biden called on fellow Americans and U.S. allies today to defend democracy.
So democracy begins with each of us. It begins when one person decides there's something more important than themselves. When they decide the person they're serving alongside of is someone to look after. When they decide the mission matters more than their life, when they decide that their country matters more than they do.
He did not mention by name his predecessor and current election rival, former President Donald Trump. Biden also used his speech in Normandy to strengthen support for Ukraine. Russia's invasion of its neighbor 2 years ago is the biggest land war in Europe since World War II. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu will address a joint session of Congress on July 24th as his country continues to wage war against Hamas. NPR's Barbara Sprunt reports the speech is likely to be contentious, with some Democrats already signaling plans to boycott.
All four top congressional leaders extended the formal invitation to Netanyahu at the end of May, inviting him to, quote, share the Israeli government's vision for defending democracy, combating terror, and establishing a just and lasting peace in the region. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer previously came under criticism for publicly calling on Israel to hold new elections. In a statement after the date of the address was finalized, Schumer said he has, quote, clear and profound disagreements with Netanyahu, but said he joined the request from congressional leaders because of America's ironclad relationship with Israel. Barbara Sprunt, NPR News, Washington.
The Washington Post publisher and chief executive is denying reports by NPR and others that he pressured his own executive editor not to report a damaging story on him. NPR's David Fogenflick reports Will Lewis stands accused in British court of helping to cover up a wide-ranging scandal at Rupert Murdoch's British tabloids more than a dozen years ago.
Lewis denies this, and he hasn't been prosecuted or even named as a defendant in the lawsuits brought by Prince Harry and others. According to four people at the Post, Lewis pressured then-executive editor Sally Busby to drop the story this spring. It published anyway. She was gone 3.5 weeks later as part of a restructuring that would have diminished her job. I had broken the story about the Lewis allegations in the UK back in December. At the time, he tried to induce me to kill my own story by giving me an exclusive interview about his plans for the Post. Yesterday, Lewis said we only spoke off the record, but our agreement didn't extend to such offers, which he did not deny making. David Fulkenflick, NPR News.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 31 points. You're listening to NPR News.
Live from KQED News, I'm Brian Watt. California is selling a growing number of electric delivery vans, buses, and big rigs. A new state report finds that one out of six new sales is zero emission. KQED's Laura Clivens has the story.
Sales of these larger zero emissions vehicles doubled from 2022 to 2023. Governor Gavin Newsom says the state is 2 years ahead of schedule.
We're proving we can get this done. We have 60 headquartered manufacturing zev companies. It's one of our largest export.
California is requiring state and local governments, large businesses, and ports to make a percentage of new truck purchases zero emission starting this year, ramping up to all new truck sales by 2036. Supporters of these requirements say they'll bring down the greenhouse gas emissions that contribute to a heating planet, along with harmful pollution and health disparities that come with it. I'm Laura Clivens, KQED News.
Caltrans plans to close one of the eastbound bores of the Caldecott Tunnel overnight three times next week to make repairs after a vehicle fire earlier this week. The agency says it will close bore number two, the left of the two eastbound tunnels, from 10 p.m. Monday to 4:30 a.m. Tuesday, and again the next two nights. Caltrans says crews plan to clean out soot in the tunnel caused by last Tuesday's fire. Sports, the Mariners shut out the A's 3-0. The A's start hosting the Blue Jays this evening. The Giants are in Texas for the weekend, starting up at 5-hour time against the Rangers. I'm Brian Watt, KQED News.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And by the listeners of KQED.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, science journalist Annalee Newitz talks about their new book, Stories Are Weapons, and how the author of classic science fiction stories also wrote the military's textbook on PSYOPs. You're going to want to hear that. Plus, scientists have found the organism with the biggest genome, and you will be surprised. But first, there was a big week of milestones for spaceflight. We saw successful notable launches from both Boeing and SpaceX within a day of each other. So what does this all say about this current moment and about the future of space travel? Here to tell us about those launches and other science news from this week is Maggie Kurth, science writer and editorial lead for Carbon Plan. Maggie, always good to have you.
Thank you so much. Always good to be here.
Let's start with this Boeing Starliner launch, because after years of delay, the crewed launch to the International Space Station finally happened, but not without a little drama, right?
Right. I mean, that's really been the theme of space news this week, is a little positive and also things are kind of janky at the same time. So this was a flight that was originally supposed to happen back in 2017, and the two astronauts are now safely on board the ISS despite some technical troubles, which included helium leaking from the system that helps pressurize the capsule's thrusters. As of Thursday, CNN was reporting that most of the leaks have been patched up and none of this posed any safety problems for the crew.
That's good to hear. And I know SpaceX, as I say, their Starship, they had a launch also, but that was pretty significant too, right?
It was. So SpaceX had its own win this week. It ran a successful launch and return of Starship, the world's most powerful rocket, for the very first time. Three earlier test launches had ended in destruction as Starship lost control or broke apart. This time, though, SpaceX was able to launch it, separate the ship from the reusable rocket booster, and land both of them safely, albeit with some reentry damage to the ship.
All right. Sticking with space, let's move to the sun a bit, okay? We've got some hot sun news, starting with this amazing video that NASA captured of a failed solar flare. It was like, whoop, never mind. Tell us about that.
Oh my gosh, it was just very cool. You've got this giant, massive solar flare erupting from the sun, only to watch most of that material get sucked right back into the sun's gravity. And this is happening in the context of a really interesting time period that we are in, because right now, the sun is at a peak of activity in its 11-year cycle. And that peak is turning out to be way more active than anyone had predicted it would be. So this is why you got that massive aurora light show back in May, which I got to go see, and it was incredibly cool.
Lucky you.
I know. I'm very pleased with myself. But these auroras are caused by these bursts of charged particles. They get ejected from the sun, they travel through space, they crash into our atmosphere, and they emit these colored lights with every collision. So the storm of particles that struck the Earth in May was the biggest since 2003, and researchers told Science News that more storms like this could happen through the end of the year and maybe even into the early months of 2025.
Wow.
And this solar ejection was kind of part of that ongoing activity. But it also kind of demonstrates how hard it is to predict which of these solar ejections are going to turn into intense auroras until they're already speeding towards Earth.
Yeah. Well, let's move on to some early human news this week, starting with a discovery of how the woolly rhinoceros went extinct 10,000 years ago. Now, there's something to talk about.
Yeah, so this is a beast that could grow to more than 6.5 feet tall. It had a 3-foot long horn, but they went extinct after the last ice age. And many scientists had believed that those rhinos were a victim of climate change. But it turns out there's reason to think their demise was more complicated than that. Researchers from Australia's University of Adelaide ran a computer model with both climate and likely points of human-rhino contact kind of added in. And over the course of tens of thousands of iterations, they found one that matched what we know from archaeological and DNA evidence, and basically came to the conclusion that the rhino's demise was the result of both climate change and human hunters.
Wow. Hunting. Who would have thunk that? Obviously they did.
Yeah. Well, and it's also something that has come up. We know that humans had a lot of responsibility for the demise of the megafauna.
Speaking of kind of the same thing, an ancient human body called Atsi the Iceman has been studied for a while, and the scientists have gotten some new insight on that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Atsi is Earth's favorite frozen mummy, and back in 2012, scientists had analyzed the Iceman's genome, but there were these oddities in it that didn't make a lot of sense with what we know about things like various population movements from other data. So now it turns out that original study had been contaminated with modern DNA, and they've done a new analysis that removes that, and it's found some really interesting details about Atsi. One of them is male pattern baldness, but also it turns out Atsi was not a white guy. The skin on that mummy is dark, but scientists had always chalked that up to the effects of being frozen in ice for more than 5,000 years. This genetic evidence, however, says he was just always brown. And that makes sense with other recent research that suggests the genes for pale skin tones did not become prevalent in Europe until somewhere between 4,000 and 3,000 years ago.
Boy, that is very interesting. Speaking of interesting, there was an interesting story this week about a town in California that decided not to move ahead with a controversial geoengineering plan. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so back in March, researchers from the University of Washington began testing this device that was meant to spray liquefied salt in a fine cloud of particles off the deck of a retired aircraft carrier. The researchers hope to find out whether spraying this salt solution into the clouds has the potential to make clouds brighter, reflecting sunlight away from the surface of the Earth, and counteracting climate change with cooling. It was basically meant to see whether the sprayer would still work regardless of the weather, but the city of Alameda halted that experiment really quickly, and officials voted this week to not allow the experiment to continue at all.
So the city of Alameda didn't want to have anything to do with that.
Yeah. I mean, there were several reports, including one produced by the city itself, that found the experiment was not dangerous. But the city's decision wasn't really about that single experiment. It's part of this ongoing debate about geoengineering research, you know, whether it should happen at all, what the risks are, what role the public should play in deciding when and how it happens. And if you read quotes from the city officials, that decision to stop the experiment really kind of just sounds like a choice of noping out of those complexities.
And some people had issues with how the scientists communicated this, right?
Yeah, there's definitely an element about the science communication here as well. The scientists didn't need permits to do this experiment, so they had not been in contact with the city. But the officials then felt like that was a big lack of transparency, and it contributed to their decision. The mayor told Politico that she actually only learned about the experiment from reading about it in the New York Times.
Wow. That's not how you want to learn about something in your own town.
It was probably kind of startling.
Yeah. Let's go down to South America because there's an unforeseen health consequence of deforestation. Is that right?
Yeah. Oropouche virus. It's a tropical disease spread by these tiny insects called biting midges. It's usually a fairly mild thing. You get a headache, body pain, nausea. But it can produce some serious side effects like brain inflammation, too. Usually, though, nobody gets it outside the Amazon basin. But this year that has changed, and there are cases turning up as far away as Cuba. And scientists are really chalking this up to a combination of factors, including warming climate that's expanding the midges' range, increased human travel in and out of the Amazon basin, and deforestation that's pushing the virus's host animals into cities and towns. It's no surprise, really, that the spread of this virus has been on the rise for about a decade, but scientists are really raising the alarm now because of the way that spread creates these new opportunities for mutation and the potential of overwhelming local healthcare systems.
Yeah, another consequence of deforestation that no one thought about in advance. Let's move back to the U.S. for a moment. The FDA this week voted against the medicinal use of MDMA. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this FDA advisory panel, they voted overwhelmingly to not recommend the approval of MDMA as a therapeutic drug, particularly for issues like PTSD. The drug, which is also known as ecstasy, was the backbone of this big recent push to test psychedelics as treatments for mental health disorders. But the panel found that the data submitted to it was weak and didn't demonstrate efficacy or safety. There's a lot of pressure on the FDA right now to approve MDMA for therapeutic use, and that's coming from the public, it's coming from some scientists, but there's really been some issues in this research. There was sexual misconduct by a therapist involved in one of the studies. There were allegations that participants in one of the phase 3 trials were being pressured not to report negative outcomes. And the participants could also pretty easily guess whether or not they'd been given the actual drug or the placebo. And that's something that the panel was also concerned could color the results
right.
that they and their therapists reported.
Wow. Yeah. Finally, we have to clear up the story that's been making the rounds this week in my social media feeds about this very colorful but kind of scary looking invasive spider called the Joro spider. It's not as harmful as it looks, right?
It is a 3-inch long venomous spider, but experts who have definitely not been paid off by big venomous spiders say there's nothing we need to worry about.
Well, the real threat lies where? It's an invasive species, right? That could harm other stuff, but not us.
Exactly. This is not a personal risk.
Yes.
They are freaked out by us. Their venom can't really hurt humans. At most, you're talking about a slight itch. But existentially, Joro spiders do give us plenty to worry about. They're one of these invasive species, and they're a highly noticeable one that is drawing attention to the damage these can do to ecosystems, from crops and trees to native animals.
Well, Maggie, we're always happy when you invade our ear space. So thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Maggie Kurth, science writer and editorial lead for Carbon Plan. We have to take a break, and when we come back, a new book looks at the history of psychological warfare, its connection to science fiction, and how it's been adapted to modern politics. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Support for KQED comes from Save the Bay, imagining a Bay Area where people and wildlife thrive. This future is possible. Turn the tide and rise to the climate challenge. More at SaveSFBayNow.org. UC Santa Cruz, where researchers discovered how often sea otters, a threatened species, use tools when feeding to survive in a rapidly changing environment. More at UCSC.edu.
President Biden won Nevada in 2020, but it was a nail-biter. This year, younger voters are pretty upset with him about cost of living, among other things.
It's like, angering because it affects everyone. Like, I'm 23 years old, and I don't think I could afford to move out on my own anytime soon into my own apartment, let alone my own house. Yeah.
Could Trump take back this crucial state? That story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 1.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When we talk about war and conflict on this program, it's often a technology story. Faster planes, more resilient armor, powerful lasers or spy satellites. Or it's a medicine story, how to help heal those devastated by warfare. But my next guest says that narrative and psychology are parts of that fabric, too. Annalee Newitz is a science journalist based in San Francisco and author of the new book, Stories Are Weapons, Psychological Warfare and the American Mind. Annalee, always great to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks again for having me back.
You're welcome. All right, tell us what led you to write this book.
You know, it really grew out of my interest in history. I had started noticing, of course, like all of us, that we are in the midst of a really difficult culture war here in the United States. And I started to get curious about where it was that culture war had come from. And I realized that one of the architects of it was actually a science fiction writer whose work I knew really well. He wrote under the name Cordwainer Smith in the 1950s and 60s, but in his other life, his name was Paul Linebarger, and he worked in military intelligence and wrote the very first army manual on psychological war. And as someone who writes science fiction and who's interested in history and science, I had to know more. And so I dove deeply into Linebarger's life. I visited his archive at the Hoover Institute at Stanford. And I just discovered all of these really interesting connections between the way that storytellers manipulate our minds and manipulate our emotions and the actual doctrine that the military uses to create these psychological weapons to undermine our enemies in warfare.
Can we define some terms? Let's talk about some of them. Misinformation, propaganda, psychological warfare. Tell us what they mean.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think the terms often get really confused. So psychological warfare is specifically launched by a military, a state power, or a non-state actor. And a PSYOP, a psychological operation, is kind of the smallest unit of psychological warfare. And this is a message that is intended to traumatize or harm the enemy by undermining morale or by confusing them. And ultimately, the goal of a PSYOP is always to get an adversary to surrender in a warfare situation. And today, we've seen a tremendous, what I would call a weapons transfer program that really gets started during the Cold War, where a lot of these military psychological weapons start getting used in domestic cultural conflicts. And that's when you start to see things like misinformation being propagated for political purposes, essentially lies that serve a particular political purpose. And you start to see propaganda being used oftentimes by U.S. politicians and leaders against Americans, which goes against military doctrine. A PSYOP is only supposed to be used against a foreign adversary. So once it spills over into the domestic space, then you start entering into weirder territory.
Yeah, because that implies that we're seeing each other as foreign adversaries. I mean, things are so polarized.
That's right. And I think that's one of the ways that we've kind of lost sight of the point of our public sphere, our domestic public sphere, where we debate and discuss and argue over all kinds of political issues, from climate change to how we handle pandemics. And when we start transferring PSYOPs into that public sphere, we can no longer have conversations as a democratic nation. We start, as you say, treating each other like foreign adversaries, and it shuts conversation down.
You know, when you were talking before, I was reminded that this is really not a new phenomenon. I mean, Sun Tzu's Art of War is full of it, isn't it?
That's right. I mean, this is certainly something that goes way back to our earliest recorded descriptions of war. Irregular warfare or simply trickery in war is super common as a strategy. But in the United States, we have a really specific brand of PSYOPs that really grows out of the 19th century wars that the U.S. government was making on hundreds of indigenous tribes in the West as the nation kind of expanded outward from its original shape. And what we see is this really specific pattern of the U.S. military using a combination of science, sometimes it's psychology, sometimes it's anthropology in the 19th century, and using pop culture. You just see a ton of effort being put into making these propaganda messages, these PSYOPs, essentially fun. And that was one of the reasons why Paul Linebarger, who, of course, lived a double life as a science fiction writer and a PSYOP crafter, why he was so important, because he was one of the folks who said, listen, we have to learn from movies. We have to learn from popular books how to make America just sound really cool and get our enemies to come over to our side because we're just awesome. And in the 19th century, where this starts really is with James Fenimore Cooper's incredibly popular novel, The Last of the Mohicans, which spreads this cultural idea, this PSYOP, that indigenous tribes are dying out. Now, if you were to show this book to the many Mohicans who are still alive and hanging out today, they would say, no, there is no last Mohican. It hasn't happened yet. But that was a very powerful meme at the time, and it really helped the U.S. government justify expansion into the West by saying, well, listen, you guys all read Last of the Mohicans. You know that these guys are just about to die out, so we might as well just go ahead and take their land.
One person who wasn't fooled was Mark Twain. As a reviewer, he took that book apart. I remember reading his review of The Last of the Mohicans.
Good for him, yeah.
But, you know, talking about fun, that's really interesting, because when I think of fun and propaganda, I'm thinking of advertising, right? I mean, that's what the whole point is, get you to buy a product. This thing is fun. It's going to help you, you know, buy an idea, an emotion.
That's right. And you really nailed it, because advertising is another huge influence on psychological war in the United States. That's one of our big innovations as a country. And several of the people in the early 20th century who are basically creating the professional field of public relations and advertising are also very involved in military intelligence operations. So a great example is Edward Bernays, who was one of the very first public relations experts. He was Sigmund Freud's nephew, and he loved using psychology in his work. And he also, in the 1950s, worked with the CIA to help overthrow the leftist leaders in Guatemala. So he kind of divided his time between advertising bananas, which was one of his big areas of interest, and trying to overthrow governments or advocate on behalf of governments using advertising. And so by the time the military is codifying what it means to create a PSYOP, when Paul Linebarger is writing his book, advertising is the model. You know, the military talks about finding a target audience in the same way that advertisers talk about finding a target market. And the point is to, again, to make the PSYOPs fun and engaging. And it's a huge aspect of American policy to do this.
Mm-hmm. Are there any common techniques, no matter what the topic, to create an us versus them situation? Is that like a textbook to tell you how to do this?
In fact, there is.
There
actually, of course, is. There are many textbooks in the military on creating PSYOPs. And there's really two ingredients that make a PSYOP. One is that it includes lies. It often has a kernel of truth somewhere. A really effective PSYOP always has a little bit of truth that's been decontextualized or recontextualized so that it provides a message that is beneficial to the sender and can undermine the enemy. The other thing that's really important to know about PSYOPs is they almost always include violent threats. And this is how you can always tell the difference in a culture war when we're talking about, you know, domestic debates, when one side of that argument is something like, those people over there shouldn't exist. Those people should be rounded up. Those people are criminals. Anytime that message goes along with a political idea, you're in the realm of PSYOPs because all of those things are violent threats.
You know, it's scary to hear that because we're sort of living through that today with the political climate we have.
We absolutely are. And this is one of the reasons I wrote the book was I wanted people to understand that when someone comes at you with that kind of comment, it's not the opening stage in a debate. It is a weapon. They're delivering weaponized messages that can't be met with rational responses. We have to change the conversation. We have to say, no, we're not going to talk about how we're going to beat each other up anymore. We're going to start a new conversation where we say, well, what do we each want out of this situation? What do we want from the future of America? And not talk about who we want dead and who we want in jail, but just where are we going next? Can we please start discussing that?
You know, back in the day, and I'm a child of the 60s, I used to listen on my shortwave radio to Radio Moscow. And I was trying to figure out what was real and what was made up. And it was very hard to do that. I mean, sometimes it can be very, very personal and, like you say, violent, but sometimes it can be really subtle, can it?
It can be really subtle. And one of the things that a number of the experts I talked to pointed out is that the Russian style of PSYOP, or at the time you were listening, the Soviet style, really is to sort of flood the zone with chaos. So there's so many messages that are untrustworthy that you never really know what's going on. And that is a way of pacifying people and undermining their sense of what's real. And that's something that's now been imported into the United States too. And we see that a lot. One of the things that's happening right now on social media with the flood of AI generated messages is that no one's really sure if they're talking to a person or a bot or if the image they're seeing is real or invented. And so we're kind of, again, this is a way in which the American people are throwing PSYOPs at each other's heads.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Cordwainer Smith. There's this interesting line throughout the book about connections and parallels between popular science fiction and propaganda operations. And part of it ties into the idea of world building. Having a believable world can help create a reality. Tell us about that.
Yeah, one of the things that you see a lot, especially in PSYOPs after the Cold War, that have really been influenced by Cordwainer Smith, but a lot of other science fiction writers who also have been involved in military intelligence, is that when we create these pieces of propaganda, we try to make them as realistic as possible using the tools of storytelling that science fiction writers often deploy. So when you're watching, say, a Star Wars movie, one of the things that makes it really immersive is that you have characters speaking different languages. You have spaceships that aren't just big blobs in the sky, but actually have like nuts and bolts and all kinds of little details that really make us feel like there's a kind of technological or scientific plausibility there. I mean, if you ignore the FTL and the midichlorians and all of that. But part of world building is to create a world where people feel like the fiction is real. And that is an incredibly powerful tool for PSYOPs and propaganda. What you want is for your adversary to start believing your message. And there's all kinds of ways that this can be done. It's obviously very easy now online to create all kinds of fictional images and movies and messages that feel very real. But back in World War II, there were very simple ways that this kind of thing was pulled off. There's a great PSYOP that Linebarger talks about in his work, where the Japanese dropped leaflets on Americans who were in the Philippines. And the leaflets were supposed to be from the U.S. Army. So it was a black propaganda pretending to be coming from their adversary. And it just said, warning, venomous snakes rampant in jungles. And so U.S. soldiers who were getting these leaflets thought that the army was warning them that they were about to walk into a jungle full of deadly snakes. And if they brought that leaflet to their commanding officer and said, what the heck is this? The officer would deny it because, of course, it hadn't come from the military. So it was a perfect way to create a conspiracy theory. Even though it was just a simple slip of paper, it was so evocative. It was like, oh my gosh, this came from us. This is about a real threat because there really are some snakes there. It would undermine morale. It would create confusion. So anything that, you know, you can make sound plausible and really immerse your target audience in a story, that's going to work great as a psyop.
Well, let's talk about if stories are weapons, are there any shields? Are there any bulletproof vests that we might adopt?
That's a great question. And that's a huge part of what I investigated in this book. What are the ways that we can create new kinds of stories? How do we change the conversation away from throwing weapons at each other to offering ideas? Historically, we've seen lots of examples of ways that people pushed back against psychological warfare. In the 19th century, indigenous nations in the West became fascinated by the ghost dance, which was a social movement. It was spiritual and political, and it was a way to gather together confederacies of tribes to sing and dance and tell stories about what America would look like without white settlers. It was a change of conversation. It wasn't responding to the military. It was saying, no, we're going to tell our own story based on our own traditions about a future we would like to see. And then later in the 20th century, in a completely different context, you had a psychologist writing a comic book called Wonder Woman, which he intended as a psyop. He actually said that he wanted to create basically a feminist psyop, a kind of culture bomb that would push back against sexist stories about women. And so Wonder Woman became this really powerful story embraced by feminists who told a tale of female triumph and autonomy at a time when women were being really discouraged from joining the political sphere, the public sphere. So we know that people living in the United States have come up with alternative stories. And people are still doing that now. We're telling stories about our communities. We're telling stories about science. We are insisting on the fact that we deserve to be alive and we deserve to be out of jail. And we should continue doing that. The whole goal is put more stories out there that can raise morale and give people hope that we can reach an end to the culture war, that we can reach disarmament.
That's great to hear, Anna Lee. It's always a pleasure to have you on our radio program.
Always happy to be here. Thanks so much.
Anna Lee Newitz, science journalist based in San Francisco, author of the new book, Stories Are Weapons, Psychological Warfare and the American Mind. It's a great book. I suggest you go out and get a copy. And you can read an excerpt of the book at sciencefriday.com/propaganda. Coming up, what organism would you think has the Earth's biggest genome? The surprising answer after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Science Friday is supported by MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software for technical computing and model-based design. MathWorks, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com. Support for Science Friday comes from Progressive Insurance. From the moment car insurance is quoted to the moment it's purchased, drivers can discover a variety of ways to stay protected. More at Progressive.com. Science Friday is also supported by BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 35,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. Science Friday is produced by the Science Friday Initiative, dedicated to increasing the public's access to scientific information. ScienceFriday.com.
This week on Science Friday. No, it's not a foghorn, it's a fish. The ocean is a lot noisier than you think. We'll talk about all things ocean sounds. how invertebrates perceive sound differently than we do, and the effect of human-generated sounds on marine life. Listen in on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
That hour of Science Friday coming up at 1 a.m. That's 1 a.m., I should say again. The support for KQED comes from the Exploratorium. Extraordinary is a new exhibition of incredible art made from shoes, light bulbs, Lego, and more. Opens June 13th at Pier 15. Tickets at exploratorium.edu/extra. Comcast Business, in partnership with Extreme Networks, presenting the first professional sports venue to be Wi-Fi 6E ready with hundreds of access points throughout Oracle Park. business.comcast.com. Coming up next at noon,
Palestinian American artist Samia Halabi's first American retrospective was cancelled amid her criticism of Israel over the war in Gaza. We visit her art studio next time here and now.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. Scientists just unearthed the largest genome of any living thing on Earth. That means if you split open one of its cells, unwound the DNA that's coiled up in the nucleus, it would stretch out more than 300 feet. That's taller than the Statue of Liberty. Now, any guesses as to whom this giant genome belongs? You might be tempted to say maybe a complex being like a person, a human, or a behemoth like a blue whale or a giant squid, or maybe your mind went to a fancy fungus. Nope, a study in the journal iScience says that the new record holder is a fern. Yes, a fern found on the island of New Caledonia in the Southwest Pacific. To put it in perspective, one of this fern's cells contains more than 50 times more DNA than one of ours does. Wow, so how did this tiny fern end up with a giant genome? And what cost? Let's talk about it. Joining me is a lead author on the study, Dr. Jaume Pelletera, evolutionary biologist at the Botanical Institute of Barcelona. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Pelletera.
Thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure for me to be here.
How excited were you by this discovery?
Well, we were absolutely astonished when we found out how big this genome was. Actually, you know, scientists have been working on this field for a long time to expand our understanding of plant genome sizes across the tree of life. But, I mean, this discovery really, really shocked us because we weren't expecting something that big.
So how big is the fern? Describe it for us.
Well, this fern is very small. It's about 10 to 15 centimeters. I don't know exactly how many inches would be because, you know.
It's like 4 to 6 inches. Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very small plant that you would probably, if you were just walking in the woods, like not focusing on finding this plant, you probably would step over it because it's like nothing that would catch your eye. It has no flowers. It's all very greeny. It's like kind of a fishbone structure. It doesn't even look like a traditional fern that you might have in mind.
So how did it catch your eye? I mean, what made you not step on it?
Yeah, well, I've been always interested in plant genome size diversity and what are the consequences of this trait in the evolution of plants. So we are interested in analyzing giant genomes because they are the exception rather than the rule. And that's make them very interesting to me. Most plants have very small genomes, and only a very few groups of plants have giant genomes. One of them is Mesipteris and its sister genus Psilotum.
So how did this sort of small fern end up with so much DNA?
Well, that's a great question. That's a $1 million question. We don't know yet. It's still actually an unresolved question. What is exactly the biological meaning of this astounding plant genome size diversity? And this extends into how exactly plants expand their genomes. At first glance, for example, we cannot see any particularity or any need for this plant to accumulate such dramatic amounts of DNA in the cells, at least not from a functional point of view.
You mean it doesn't need all that DNA, is what you're saying?
No, it doesn't, because the actual functional DNA, which is the one that contains coding protein genes, is very small, and it's comparable to plants with very small genomes. So the rest is repetitive DNA, which for a long time, scientists call like junk DNA, because it apparently had no function. Now we know it has some roles to play, but it's very, very repetitive and it has no, it's not the main function.
Right. Well, having such a big genome, that's sort of a bad thing for a plant, isn't it?
Yeah, it's mostly a bad thing. And this is because there are several costs that increase and are associated with maintaining a functional large genome. And this is, for example, the requirement for nutrients. For example, nitrogen and phosphorus, which are the main essential contributors to DNA. A plant with a large genome requires lots of these elements, and sometimes they are not available in the environment. And also, for example, every time a cell divides, it needs to copy the whole strand of DNA. So this is a lot of work to replicate every time the cell. So that slows down their life cycles.
So this is a puzzle then about why this has so much DNA.
It is indeed, yeah. We know that most plants are very efficient to remove it. So all these repetitive DNA sequences that populate the genome have, some of them have the ability to move around and replicate themselves. So the plant, even if it doesn't have a brain, is very clever. It has a very efficient machinery that as soon as these elements amplify, they are detected, they are labeled, and they are targeted and removed from the genome. But we don't know yet why in some plant groups these processes are not as efficient.
Do we know why then this plant has more DNA than animals, let's say?
Oh, well, we don't know yet. We don't know yet. It might be that there is some sort of selective advantage for this fern that lives in a very particular, like, stable environment, restricted to it, and it has found the right conditions to cope with having such a big genome.
Does this discovery challenge anything we know about genomes or plant DNA?
Well, it will definitely. I mean, not just this discovery, but it will challenge how do we see the structure of the DNA in the nuclei. Because from a DNA sequence point of view, we have the technology to produce massive amounts of DNA sequences. We have the potential, the computational power to analyze and assemble probably these genomes. But we don't know yet how the 3D structure of the nuclei stands up. What are the intimate, like, relationships between all the molecules that enable the integrity of these nuclei to be maintained, given the vast amount of DNA? And for that, we will need, like, high microscopy technologies that probably will help us understand a bit more. Because right now, we are pretty ignorant about the overall structure. How is this maintained and regulated?
Are you just amazed that you could have stepped on this fern that you didn't and missed the whole discovery?
If I'm honest with you, if I had been walking in the woods without looking for it, it would have gone missing. And that this is something I have to acknowledge to our New Caledonian colleagues, because they were critical contributors to this work, because they showed us where these plants grow and help us to, you know, make this story successful. Otherwise, it would have been unknown.
You know, Nobelist physicist Richard Feynman once talked about the beauty of flowers and plants and how you might look at the outside and love it, but there's also a complicated beauty that goes on inside the plant that needs to be discovered and amazed at also.
Yeah, and this is the case. This very humble plant hides a very, very powerful and shocking secret in its genome. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, and congratulations on finding this.
Well, thank you very much for reaching out, and it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you today.
Thank you, Dr. Jaume Pellicera, evolutionary biologist at the Botanical Institute of Barcelona. You may have seen the headlines from our neighbors to the south this week. Mexico elected an historic president. Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo is the country's first female president and was an environmental engineer before entering politics. But Mexico's scientific community is split on how this election will impact science and research in the country. Here with me to help break down the reaction to this election is my guest, Rodrigo Perez Ortega, reporter for Science Magazine, based in Mexico City. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. As you know, there were lots of headlines here in the U.S. talking about how big of a deal this election will be for science, because Claudia Sheinbaum is a leftist and a climate scientist. But I understand that things are a bit more complicated than that, right? How do you explain her politics to people outside of Mexico?
You're very correct that things are more complicated. So at first phase, Claudia Sheinbaum Pardo and this election, you know, it's very progressive. And of course, everybody should say, oh, she's a scientist, she will help science. But as you said, it's more complicated. So the context comes from this present administration, this president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. He's a populist and he rules this party, Morena, that was founded by him a couple of years ago. And so Claudia Sheinbaum is very close to him, and a lot of people are worried that she's going to continue the attacks on science that he has perpetrated. So let me give you a more context on that. His administration has pursued policies deeply unpopular here for scientists, including cuts to research spending, controversial restructuring of Mexico's main science agency, CONACYT, and also we call them these mega projects like the Maya Train that are very environmentally destructive. So the context here is that we have this progressive new president that comes from science. She's a physicist. She did a PhD in environmental engineering, but he's also part of this continuation of, let's call it, one of the most hostile administrations for science in the recent decades. So yes, the scientific community is very split here in that regard.
Right. So they're sort of holding their breath, waiting to see what happens?
Exactly. And you know, she has been very vague on many things that will happen to science. A lot of people are hoping that, you know, because she's a former scientist, she will support science because she understands how research works, how funding works, you know, all these things that are long-term and not just tied to one administration, which is 6 years here in Mexico. But also, she has given all the signs that she will continue the projects of this administration. One of the contention points is a new science law. So this law was pushed by the current president. We call him AMLO, for short for Andrés Manuel López Obrador. And this law was very controversial because it was basically centralizes a lot of power into this science agency here that controls most of the budget and the spending on research. So it centralizes all the power, and it's flooded with this ideology of anti-neoliberal science, what they call it, right? So basically all the science that was done in previous administrations. So scientists are very worried that this new science law is steeped with ideology and not really realistic to how research has been working for so many years here. When I talked to Claudia Sheinbaum some weeks ago, she was very open to revisiting dialogues with the community. What happened in this administration was that a lot of these changes in regulation and restructuring on the science law, they didn't take the viewpoints of the scientific community. So they want to heal this fracture with this new president who is a scientist. And I think that's the first step that they're hoping to do is revisit this law and change it, basically.
Very interesting. I know that Mexico is a big oil and gas country. How could her election affect policy on that since she has this background?
I think that is one of the major points where she is, or her proposals are different, and also her actions from the current president, because this current administration has invested a lot in oil and gas and a refinery. At some point, they used funds dedicated to science, and they invested in buying the Deer Park refinery in Texas, for example, which angered a lot of scientists. But her actions as mayor of Mexico City speak that, you know, she has another agenda for renewable energies. She introduced a lot of electric buses in the city, invested in one of the largest, if not the largest, solar panel plant in Latin America. And when she was a researcher, she was one of the first to introduce the idea or study the idea of electric vehicles in Mexico City and how would that impact greenhouse gas emissions, you know. So I think that's one of the hopeful changes that scientists are waiting from her administration.
So you'll be watching it and watching her and the impact on science policy.
Definitely.
How does a scientist deal with politics now that she's the head of the country? Boy.
It's very interesting. You know, scientists, they were all very silent in the past years, you know, always advocating for more for more budgets and resources, of course, because so that's one of the changes also in the new law. Previously in the science law, it was established that the country had to spend at least 1% of its GDP in research or science in general. And, you know, no administration had ever reached that level. But with this new science law that was introduced last year, that was gone. So there was no, you know, even if no president was able to achieve that, now there was no goal, right? So I think with all these changes, scientists, you know, they even protested at some point of all these restructuring of the science agency and budget cuts. So scientists have been very active, or at least a section of them have been very active in the past 6 years, lobbying for science and asking for more, you know, more participation in these decisions. So now there are civil organizations from scientists that are involved in science policy. So I think that's a good thing that hasn't happened before. And I think now the scientific community and these groups of scientists will be much more involved watching what Shane Bampardo is going to be, and especially the science agency that has been very controversial under this administration.
Well, Rodrigo, we're going to depend on you to be our eyes and ears in the science in Mexico for us. So I want to thank you for taking time to be with us today.
No, thank you.
Rodrigo Perez Ortega is a reporter for Science Magazine based in Mexico City. And that about wraps up this hour. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
Annie Nero,
Emma Gomez,
Charles Bergquist,
Danielle Johnson,
Dee Peterschmidt,
Sandy Roberts,
Beth Ramey,
John Dankowski.
Thank you, everybody. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. And of course, if you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. You can always reach us all week on social media, or how about the old-fashioned way? Yeah, email. Our address, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow.
Science Friday is supported by the Simons Foundation, advancing the frontiers of research in mathematics and the basic sciences. More at simonsfoundation.org. Science Friday is also supported by Schmidt Sciences, a philanthropy founded by Eric and Wendy Schmidt, and the Dana Foundation. Learn how they explore the connections between neuroscience and society at dana.org. Science Friday is produced by the Science Friday Initiative, dedicated to increasing the public's access to scientific information. Learn more about their work at sciencefriday.com.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Coming up next, it's Here and Now. Coming up this week in KQED Science, how to stay cool and safe during a California heat wave. plus the untapped potential of rooftop solar on non-residential buildings. You can find those stories and more at kqed.org/science. You can find traffic and more. We don't want more. We just want a little bit of traffic. Hi, Julie Deppish.
Sandy, we do have some trouble on the Skyway in San Francisco on eastbound 80 at 4th Embarcadero. It's a two-car wreck. They were blocking. They're on the right shoulder.